Do you sometimes worry about the uncertainty of knowledge? Stuff you know, just know, and there can be no doubt. But then, just like that dreaded klaxon on QI on telly, up comes the screen with no, wrong, even though the wrongness may be a quibble about detail. Well, to be specific, I have long known that the high temperatures on Venus were caused by very high carbon dioxide and the greenhouse effect. After all, that was found by the great Carl Sagan, wasn't it? And backed up by our own late Dr. David Allen. But no, the renowned physicist from Queensland, Professor Frank Stacey, is here to tell us that it's all false. Something else causes temperatures to exceed 400 degrees C. But what about greenhouse itself, here on Earth? Anything debatable there? Frank Stacey was physics professor at the University of Queensland and is a fellow of the Australian Academy of Science.
Current concern about the greenhouse effect and global warming prompts a consideration of the definition of the expression greenhouse effect. Although it has arisen as an analogy to the operation of a glass greenhouse, the analogy is imperfect. As applied to the atmospheric effect, it is the warming of the surface by sunlight and partial blocking of outgoing radiant heat by the opacity of atmospheric carbon dioxide and water vapour to thermal radiation. There is no physical barrier to air movement or to loss of heat by convection, as there is in a greenhouse, in which air temperature is controlled by vents. The mechanisms are different. But whether the loss of heat is inhibited by properties of the atmosphere or by a glass barrier, a necessary feature is heating of a surface by sunlight. I take this as basic to the definition and find it helpful in understanding what the greenhouse effect can or cannot do. It offers a test for validity of arguments about greenhouse-mediated global warming. A hypothesis that has achieved some prominence, but fails to meet this feature of the definition, concerns the very high surface temperature of Venus, about 460 degrees centigrade. The massive carbon dioxide atmosphere of Venus invited the inference that this is a result of an extreme or runaway greenhouse effect. There is an alarming but implausible implication that it is possible for the effect to be that strong. The cloud in the Venus atmosphere is very dense and prevents anything more than very weak diffuse sunlight reaching the surface. There can be no greenhouse effect because the surface is not heated by sunlight. The high temperature has a different explanation. The atmosphere is stirred by vigorous winds, with the gas repeatedly compressed and decompressed by the vertical components of its motion. The temperature rises as it is compressed by moving downwards and is cooled by moving upwards, establishing a temperature gradient similar to, but much stronger than, the gradient in the Earth's atmosphere. The effect is very strong because the atmosphere is dense, with a surface pressure 90 times our atmospheric pressure. There is a radiation balance with sunlight at a level roughly coinciding with the cloud tops, and the relationship between the temperature there and at the surface is simply a consequence of compression heating. There is no greenhouse effect. Coming back down to the Earth, the central question that is addressed in models of the atmosphere and its interactions with sunlight and with the Earth and oceans is this. What temperature rises must be expected for different assumptions about emissions of the greenhouse gases, especially carbon dioxide? The models generally assume an equilibrium state, that is, steady greenhouse gas concentrations and constant atmosphere and ocean temperatures. It would be easier to compare the models with the real Earth if the Earth were in an equilibrium state, but that is far from the present situation. We are in a transient state of rapid change, and I want to consider how different this is from an equilibrium state. The biggest differences are caused by the oceans. They're absorbing both heat and carbon dioxide, but are not keeping up with the atmospheric changes. The present imbalance between the energy received from the sun and the energy radiated to space is about a quarter of 1% of the radiation that reaches the surface. It may sound like a small difference, but that difference amounts to a lot of energy, and the imbalance cannot persist for long without dramatic consequences. But its magnitude is obscured to casual observation by the fact that at least 90% of it is absorbed by the oceans. Even the melting of glacial and polar ice is included in the other 10%. The oceans are warming up, but their heat capacity is very large, and the temperature lag, relative to equilibrium with the atmosphere, is more than 100 years. That is how long it will take to see the full effect even of the greenhouse gases emitted so far. The oceans must come to equilibrium with the atmosphere, although that will be delayed while greenhouse gas concentrations and the net heat input to the Earth continue to rise. What will happen as equilibrium is approached? The oceans will stop absorbing the excess heat, and it will be redistributed in two ways. The atmospheric temperature will rise further, increasing the radiation to space, and heat will be diverted to melting glacial and polar ice. The ultimate equilibrium will be reached when ice stops melting or even disappears, and the increased temperature suffices to radiate away all of the heat. But before that, there will be a prolonged intermediate state of accelerated ice melting, with a dramatic effect on sea level. Melting of the Arctic ice cap will not contribute because it is floating, and only displaces the amount of water that it will produce by melting. Grounded ice is the problem, and the big stores of it are on Greenland and Antarctica. If 50% of the heat now going into the oceans is diverted to melting this ice, the rate of sea level rise will increase from the present 3.3 millimetres per year to more than 3 centimetres per year, that is, up to 3 metres in a human lifetime, and, perhaps eventually, 10 centimetres per year. These numbers reflect the fact that ice melting is far more effective increasing the volume of ocean water than is thermal expansion. This is emphasised by pointing out that, since the peak of the last ice age, sea level has risen by 120 metres. If this had to be explained by thermal expansion, the entire ocean would be at boiling point. The long-term concern about sea level arises from ice melting, not thermal expansion. This leads to another question. Why is Antarctic ice melting more slowly than Arctic ice? As I've mentioned, the ocean is absorbing heat, and this means that they are effectively preventing it from reaching the ice. This is more noticeable in the southern hemisphere, which has far more ocean. To reach Antarctica, warmed air must cross a vast expanse of ocean that is below the temperature of equilibrium with the air and absorbs much of the excess heat. By contrast, the Arctic is more closely surrounded by land masses, which are not significant absorbers of net heat. As equilibrium is approached, that difference will disappear. Antarctica will lose the protection of the Southern Ocean and melt faster. Essential information about the close relationship between global temperature and atmospheric carbon dioxide for the last several hundred thousand years has been provided by ice cores from Antarctica and Greenland. The carbon dioxide concentration oscillated between two approximate limits, 200 parts per million during ice age peaks and 280 parts per million during warm interglacial periods. This is what would be expected from the variation with temperature of the solubility of carbon dioxide in seawater. Cold ice age oceans dissolve more of the gas, extracting it from the atmosphere, but returned it to the atmosphere when they warmed up. The atmosphere and oceans exchanged carbon dioxide, but as nearly as can be determined, until recent times, the total has been constant for the last million years. Volcanic sources have been balanced by sequestering processes, mainly the formation of carbonate rocks. But the present rate at which carbon dioxide is produced by fossil fuel burning and cement production is more than 100 times the rate of release by volcanoes. There is no way that natural processes can accommodate that increase. The excess will remain in the atmosphere-ocean system indefinitely, and the consequences will last just as long. Moreover, with a warmer Earth, the oceans will hold a reduced share, enhancing the atmospheric content and consequent greenhouse warming. The anthropogenic greenhouse effect is essentially permanent, adding a temperature increment to whatever changes occur naturally. The next ice age that might have been anticipated has already been prevented, and probably also the following one. The hope that the temperature rise can be restricted to 2 degrees appears forlorn. The stratosphere presents subtle evidence of the basic physics of the greenhouse effect. Whereas the troposphere, roughly the lowest 11 kilometres of the atmosphere, is warming, the stratosphere is cooling. It has very little water vapour, which is essential to the greenhouse effect at lower elevations, but it has the same proportion of carbon dioxide. In the stratosphere, it shares the greenhouse role with ozone. The stratosphere is tenuous enough to allow thermal radiation from carbon dioxide to escape, and the increase in its concentration is increasing the rate of radiation escape. Mars presents another example of the same effect. Its thin atmosphere is dominated by carbon dioxide, but, as in the stratosphere, its greenhouse effect is negative, resulting in a surface temperature lower than equilibrium with solar radiation would suggest. Some commentators have pointed out that the opposite effects in the troposphere and stratosphere provide a convincing confirmation of the greenhouse explanation, because other possible causes of tropospheric temperature increase, such as variations in solar output, would also increase the stratospheric temperature. Another subtlety in the interpretation of global temperatures arises from the ellipticity of the Earth's orbit. The Earth is closer to the Sun and receives 7% more sunlight on January the 4th than on July the 4th. This is a big difference, and might have been expected to cause an annual variation of almost 5 degrees in the mean global temperature. Asymmetry of the hemispheres, with oceans concentrated in the south and continents in the north, has some effect, but the underlying reason why no such dramatic variation is observed is astronomical. The second of Kepler's laws of planetary motion states that the speed at which a planet moves in its orbit varies with distance from the Sun in such a way that a line from the Sun to the planet sweeps out equal areas in equal times. In modern jargon, this is conservation of angular momentum. A planet moves faster when it is closer, precisely compensating for the fact that it receives more intense sunlight. This is a corollary to Kepler's second law. The radiation received by a planet is the same in all equal angular segments of its orbit. Although the Earth receives stronger sunlight in the southern hemisphere summer, the summer is shorter, and the total radiation received is the same in both hemispheres. This is an example of a principle that needs to be applied to climate change studies quite generally. Ignore short-term and transient effects, even those occurring in our lifetimes, and look for long-term trends. Then we see that the problem we are creating will be faced by future generations.
And this message matches that from the Australian Academy of Science last month, which issued a briefing on climate. Frank Stacey is a fellow of the Academy and was Professor of Physics at the University of Queensland. Next week, go suck a lemon. David Mabberley, former director of the Royal Botanic Gardens in Sydney, talks on citrus. I'm Robin Williams.